This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Jeremiah Jacques, filling in for Mr. Joel Hilliker today. And with me is our panel. Here in the studio, we have Andrew Miller.
Hello.
And joining us from the UK is Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And Mihailo Zekic.
Hello.
And from Jerusalem, Israel, we have Brent Noctical.
Good to be with you.
Well, the Islamic Republic of Iran has held its presidential elections today. And even by Iranian standards, this was just a farce and a mockery of democracy. To bring us up to speed on this, we'll go to Brent Noctical.
Yeah, so this election, the way it works out is that there are a lot of people, anyone really, that can sign up to try and make it to the ballot inside Iran. But then there is an unelected council that vets potential candidates and cuts that list down dramatically. Typically, there's about 1,500 people that would try and sign up. And then that would be cut down again by this expediency council. This year, there was about 500 people, which kind of shows that people no longer believe there's any chance of them actually making it to the ballot. And of the people that were admitted, there was a preponderance of what we would call hardliner, ultra-conservative, religious figures that were either related to the clerical regime or to the IRGC, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps. And typically you would have pragmatists, those like Rouhani, the current president, that form part of the ballot. But this year it's like the Ayatollah and this council that really does pick the people that he wants to be a part of the on the list, that he is kind of ditching with the pretense of the need to try and placate the West with some softer options for the Iranians. He's basically putting forth his hardliners, saying, pick your best out of all of these leaders. And I would liken a lot of them, or some of them that are left, three of them already bailed the day before the election, so it was down to four as of Friday morning. I would liken them to Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. He is not on the list. He's actually, it seems, from a lot of his speeches and things, gone a bit softer over the years since he was, you know, calling for Israel to be destroyed and all of that. However, those that remain really do follow along that fundamentalist idea and have been extremely bold with their rhetoric against the Jewish state, against the United States as well. And so they don't really, if you're an Iranian that doesn't believe in the Islamic Revolution, of course, you're never going to have a choice, because all of the people that are ever on this list believe in the Islamic Revolution. But if you're somebody that wants to try and further the revolution with a moderate in power, like Rouhani, you didn't get that option this year. You only had hardliners to choose from.
So the Ayatollah seems to be absolutely sure that the Biden administration in the U.S. will give Iran sanctions relief, even while Iran is really just showing its fanatical colors for the whole world to see.
Yeah, I think this is a really good comparison with what happened in the 2013 election when Rouhani was elected. If people go back then, we have a really similar situation to what we have right now in relation to Iran nuclear deal, sanctions that are on the Iranians and such. And back then, we had the Obama administration that wanted to pursue a nuclear deal with Iran, but wanted to use this idea that Iran now has a moderate president in power, in Rouhani. And so this is our chance to pursue. They have a moderate. Let's pursue a closer relationship with Iran. Mahmoud Ahmadinejad is gone. And the Iranian, the Ayatollah and everyone, they obliged. They produced a moderate figure to pass the JCPOA on the American public, to use that, the echo chamber in the media. Ben Rhodes admitted that this was the plan. Let's use the moderate storyline and let's tell the West that this is the only chance we have to stop Iran from making a nuclear weapon. Of course, the nuclear negotiations began a year earlier under Mahmoud Ahmadinejad anyway with the U.S. That was a lie, this false narrative. However, this year we have a new nuclear deal, or at least the United States is there trying to get back in the deal. You would think if the Ayatollah was worried that the United States would not come back into this deal, if he had a hardliner in power, a hardliner as the president, that he would have produced again another Rouhani figure for the people to vote for. However, he didn't do that. He's so confident that sanction relief is coming that he's hoisting up the colors of the fanatical Islamic Republic, the regime, and he's saying, this is what we are, and what are you going to do about it? Are you still going? He's so confident that he's still going to get sanction relief that he's showing the world that we all of us here in Iran, or at least the regime, believe in terrorism, believe in what we've known the regime to be, their modus operandi now for the past 40 years.
So Iran is growing more bold. That's apparent, I think, in the way the deck was stacked with this election. And that's something that Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has forecast would happen as the U.S. grows more appeasing and more capitulating. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's obvious that when you have sanctions relief that are going to come no matter what you do, then you might as well just put forward the candidate that you want. And right now that looks to be Ibrahim Raisi. He is the candidate that the Ayatollah wants, and he's probably going to win as well. Again, when you don't have any type of international pressure to present yourself as a moderate, then why have that facade? And this speaks to the boldness and the confidence that the Iranians have right now. I listened to a press briefing yesterday about this where retired Lieutenant Colonel Michael Sigal, an Israeli commentator on Iran, he said that the Iranian regime is in the mood right now of divine intervention. And what he meant by that is he sees everything that has happened over the past 6 months. Trump gone, Netanyahu gone. He sees the last round of Iranian-inspired violence, of Hamas firing rockets on Israel, how that was successful. He sees the Israeli Arabs rising up in support of Hamas. That was successful. And so they're not hiding anything anymore. They believe God is on their side. They used to hide the fact that they were supporting the Houthis in Yemen, that they were supporting the Palestinian groups, that they were trying to take over Iraq through the Shiite militias. No, they're not related to us, they used to say. Now they readily admit, yes, that's what we're doing. Yes, we back the Palestinians. Yes, we back the Houthis. And what are you going to do about it? Again, Netanyahu's gone. They successfully, as they saw it, still were able to sell oil on the market, even though there was maximum pressure from the Trump regime, presidency. They outlasted that. And so life is good for them. And so we see this change, I would say, from the Iranians, that they were bold before, they were aggressive before, but it was under a cover. It was cloaked by some of their rhetoric. Now the rhetoric is changing. Now they admit a lot of what their goals are. And that definitely does speak to what we know in biblical prophecy of what the Iranian regime is likened to. They are likened in Daniel chapter 11 and verse 40 as the king of the south that pushes other foreign powers towards war. They have an extremely pushy foreign policy. They don't back down. And yet what's also interesting about this is they have an extreme overconfidence of their abilities. And that's what the prophecy bears out, that they are going to push so hard and they are going to be absolutely wiped out in an instant in a blitzkrieg attack by a German-led Europe. But I don't think they necessarily think that's going to happen, because they're driven by this religious fanaticism. They're driven by the years or decades, let's say, of appeasement from the West, that the retribution that comes upon them, it seems that they don't even expect. And what we see in the Iranians now through this election is an extreme overconfidence. And that aligns perfectly with this prophecy that Mr. Fleury talks about in his book, The King of the South.
Brent has written an article about this. It's called Wolves in Wolves Clothing, Fill Ballot in Iranian Election. That's a great title, Brent, and a great article, too. It's up on thetrumpet.com right now. And you can also find The King of the South by Mr. Gerald Fleury there. That takes a deep dive into Daniel 11 and the prophecies that Brent just mentioned there. So visit us at thetrumpet.com to learn more about this important story. Thanks very much for that, Brent. For the next story, we'll take a look at Germany, where some disturbing signs emerged this week showing how some in the army view Germany's Nazi past. For this, we'll go to Richard Palmer.
Yes, some pretty disturbing allegations emerged this week. Around 30 German servicemen who were in the army as part of Germany's mission in Lithuania, as part of the NATO's enhanced forwards presence, where they're stationed in Lithuania. They're there to conduct joint exercises, to train local units in Lithuania, and to prepare to respond to any kind of Russian attack. Perhaps the most startling of the accusations was that these soldiers were singing Happy Birthday to Adolf Hitler. This was coming right around the 80th anniversary of Hitler's invasion of Russia. There's all kinds of reports of anti-Semitism, of extremism. There's also reports of sexual assault and things like that from these soldiers. They're accused of giving offense with racist and anti-Semitic overtones and showing extremist behavior, a military spokesman said. And this, you know, these accusations have caused a big stir within Germany. And I think, to me, what's in some ways most remarkable about them is where this is coming from. You know, this is a pretty politically sensitive overseas posting. It took a long time after World War II for German troops to be stationed outside of Germany's borders. And now you've got German troops stationed in Eastern Europe, right on the border with Russia. It's a location where I think if you were the German army, you would go out of your way to try and make sure that your soldiers were on their best behavior. Yet, even with all that, we saw this kind of behavior emerge, and with all of that historical baggage behind it. So just to have German troops stationed on the border with Russia in Eastern Europe, and then they quite quickly, openly, a small handful celebrating Hitler, is a very disturbing news event.
So this was just one platoon of soldiers who were caught engaging in this, you know, as you said, very disturbing and shameful behavior. But this is actually an increasingly pervasive problem throughout much of Germany. Could you talk a little bit about just the wider problem here?
Certainly. Yeah. You're absolutely right. It's one platoon of soldiers, and it's the kind of thing where it could be easy to say, okay, it's 30 people, it's bad, but you could probably find 30 extremists in just about any army. But then you start putting it in the much wider context, and you just see this is just one after another of a whole pattern of events in the German army. You know, it was just a month or two ago where, for example, we were talking about one member of the German army who had been arrested because he was stockpiling weapons and planning to assassinate politicians and frame migrants for doing so. So he would then have an excuse to go and attack migrants. You've had one of the most elite units of the German army, the KSK, basically now on the point of being disbanded because the authorities are, they see that Nazism in this particular organization is so baked in. They've tried removing just bits and pieces, and they're talking now of just getting rid of it. Their most elite units, the Germany Special Forces, because they're so thoroughly infiltrated. There have been studies after studies and incidents after incidences where soldiers have been found celebrate or venerating Hitler or joining some of these far-right movements. And then even within, say, investigative units in the army, the kind of the military police, some of these units that are meant to ferret out these type of individuals have instead been found guilty of covering it up or tipping off people saying, hey, look, they're starting to investigate this. You should probably pipe down for a little bit now. So what you see, the picture when you look at the full context, isn't a one-off with 30 idiots in Lithuania. It is a pattern of behavior that is there for a long time in the German military. It's very clear that there is a big problem with extremism here in the German military, and that has that pattern has to lead to much bigger, wider questions.
Yes. So clearly, as you said, this goes far beyond just this most recent incident. What would you say this tells us about Germany's future?
That's a question that not enough people, I think, are asking. I mean, you look, this idea of there being extremists infiltrating and hiding, the German army is not the only place where they found this. There have been study after study in reputable publications like Spiegel or in even government investigations finding that after World War II, neo-Nazis thoroughly infiltrated the intelligence services, the judicial services, the chancellor's office, just about every branch of German government. And too few people are saying, well, what does that mean for the future of Germany? And when you look at the picture, what you see is a very clear, something that Herbert W. Armstrong forecast very precisely right after World War II has happened. And on May 9th, 1945, he said, "We don't understand German thoroughness. Now a Nazi underground is methodically planned. They plan to come back and to win on the third try." And we can say indisputably he was correct. I don't think that's not an opinion. That is absolutely vindicated by the facts. They went underground in all these different departments. And then the fact that 70, 80 years later, you can look to the German army and see signs of this underground and see signs of extremism that, again, isn't a few isolated individuals, but even has institutional links, does raise massive questions about the future. And the way to answer those questions is to go back and look at what Mr. Armstrong said. He was right about his forecast then. So what did he say about what came next? And really, he wasn't right because he was an incredible forecaster. He was right because of revealed Bible prophecy, because he was basing that forecast on what the Bible says. And so, it said there were very specific passages in Revelation chapter 17 and verse 8, for example, that talks about a beast power, this destructive empire that goes underground. It goes into hiding. And then it says it's going to come back. And it says when it does, the world is going to be astonished. It'll be amazed. It thought it was wiped out. And then it came back. And so what you're seeing in Germany is signs that it is on the way back. And I had an article about a year ago called "Why Does Germany Have So Many Neo-Nazi Conspiracies?" And it focuses specifically on the armed forces and gives a lot more examples of these conspiracies, but then also talks about what the Bible says, takes you through some of those scriptures and shows how this is exactly prophesied. And that's critical to know because it is going to be a shocking and even terrifying thing as this comes fully into the open. And we're seeing it more and more. But once it's fully in the open, but knowing that it was forecast in the Bible and it's part of God's plan is just critical then to having hope and knowing that God is in charge of all of these events.
We will include a link to the article that Richard just mentioned there. It's called "Why Does Germany Have So Many Neo-Nazi Conspiracies?" We'll also link to an article written just this week by Josue Michels. It's called "German Soldiers Celebrating Hitler's Birthday, Just Like in the Old Days." So please check out thetrumpet.com for those stories and just to understand what's happening in Germany in the prophetic context. Well, thanks very much for that, Richard. We will take a look at Russia now, where President Vladimir Putin has just held a notable summit with the U.S. president in Geneva. For this, we'll go to Mihailo Zekic.
Yeah, well, one of the biggest stories that's been circling the media from all around the world is the Putin-Biden summit in Geneva, Switzerland. That happened this Wednesday, June 16th. There was a lot of hype going on about the meeting beforehand. The famous Time magazine cover, or now famous, with a very confident-looking Joe Biden with sunglasses on, and you could see in the reflection of the glasses Putin in there, like this. He's going to take on Putin. There's been a lot of comparisons beforehand, before the summit happened, between Geneva and the Helsinki summit between U.S. President Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin, and how it's going to be totally different. Biden, he was the chair of the Senate Foreign Affairs Committee. He's had decades of experience of this. He's going to have a much more professional take on this than Donald Trump did. This was, of course, all before the summit actually happened. And now that the summit has happened, you can see it. They were very optimistic in their outlook, and it wasn't well-founded. Now, the summit, of course, was in secret. There was Joe Biden, Vladimir Putin, the foreign minister of Russia, Sergei Lavrov, the U.S. Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, and occasionally some media to take photographs, and the translators, of course. So we don't know exactly what was said. They decided to, breaking precedent that's since the days of George H.W. Bush, the two world leaders decided not to hold a joint press conference. Normally, Russian and American leaders, since Bush and Gorbachev, would hold joint press conferences. They decided not to do it this time. Instead, Putin and Biden have held separate press conferences. And a number of things can be gleaned from this. Most specifically, what was not said, especially when you look at Joe Biden's press conference. A lot of talk, rightly so, was about the cyber attacks coming most likely from Russian soil on things like the Colonial Pipeline, one of the main energy arteries in the United States, or a few other major infrastructure attacks that occurred in Russia, whether it was the Russian government or hackers or not. It's a bit unknown at this point, but even if it was private individuals, Russia is sanctioning their activity. And there was a little bit of, for lack of a better word, finger wagging from Biden. He didn't really make too many credible threats to sort of pressure Putin or any serious attempt. He was basically saying, you can't do this to us. This is immoral. And he even gave a list, he said, of 16 different critical infrastructure areas in American infrastructure that are off limits for hacking, which raises a few eyebrows, as in, we don't have the list, didn't say what they were, but raises a few eyebrows in that, well, okay, does that mean everything that wasn't covered on the list is fair game or whatnot? And even, you know, telling a geopolitical adversary that, you know, this, if you want to hurt us, these are the places you go after, when they have a proven record of going after very critical parts of America's infrastructure, it's not the smartest thing to do. He talked a bit about that, but it's interesting on what he didn't cover. Mainly, just ahead of the summit, the Russian Navy held its largest exercise in the Pacific Ocean since the end of the Cold War, about 300 to 500 miles west of Hawaii. That's pretty far away from Russia. Given the timing of all that, the size and everything like that, it's pretty obvious it was a provocation. American jets were scrambling to intercept them, but the exercise technically happened outside of the air defense identification zone. So there was minimal of that. But you would think, you know, if your adversary is trying to provoke you, like, you think that would even at least be mentioned.
Yeah, it was very interesting. I think that that President Biden didn't mention Nord Stream 2 at all. He didn't mention those Russian provocations with the naval drills. Also, the Belarus skyjacking, at least according to the official reports, went undiscussed at this meeting. So it really seems like President Biden went pretty soft on Putin and also legitimized him, in a sense, in the eyes of the world. He brought him out of isolation, and I think will make it easier for European leaders, for example, to start to establish warmer relations with President Putin. What can you tell us about how this fits into the prophetic context?
Well, in Luke 21, there's a prophecy about that concerns a great tribulation, a very hard time coming on the world, and it specifically mentions it being the times of the Gentiles. And you look at, and if you look at some of our literature, like the United States and Britain, prophecy explains who Israel is, America, Britain, the English-speaking peoples. They've been in control of the world affairs and global stability for the longest time. And this summit is a textbook example of the Israelite powers going down and foreign Gentile powers like Russia rising up as a big spectacle to the world. And our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, has written a lot, especially about Vladimir Putin and how he plays a role into all this. He wrote a booklet called The Prophesied Prince of Russia that analyzes a prophecy in Ezekiel 28 about a prince of Gog, Magog, and Rosh, it should be translated. And the booklet explains that these are all prophetic names of the ancient peoples of Russia, and how he's going to play a massive role in this end time, a very feared man that has control, that has all these different Asian nations looking up to him, including powerful countries like China and India, powerful countries that could field their powerful leaders in their own right, but they're all looking to him for leadership, which shows, which means that he's going to amass a lot more power than he already has. And this summit just demonstrates how much power he has. And with the weakness of the U.S. and an ascendant Russia, you can expect him to get a lot more power in the near future.
We will include a link to the booklet, The Prophesied Prince of Russia, in the show notes for today's program. Well, thanks very much for that, Mihailo. For the next story, we'll stay on the topic of the Biden administration, and we'll take a look at a plan that was just released to counter domestic terrorism in the United States. For this, we'll go to Andrew.
Yeah, on Tuesday, the Biden administration released a new plan on countering domestic terrorism, and it's quite different from most of the old plans America's had on countering domestic terrorism. And the key difference that jumps out at you when you go through that is that, especially since the 9/11 terrorist attacks in 2001, for most of the past 20 years, America's strategy on countering domestic terrorism has focused largely on radical Islam. The Obama administration tried to downplay that somewhat, but this new plan hardly mentions Islamic terrorism at all, and focuses almost exclusively on the threat of white supremacists. And it gives about $100 million in funding to the Department of Justice and the Department of Homeland Security and the FBI. And most the provisions inside it are to do with purging the military of extremists, retraining veterans who are retiring from the military to make sure that they don't become extremist, and purging extremist content from the internet. And so now initially, I mean, the internet thing does raise an eyebrow about over some free speech concerns. But the idea of like training former veterans and stuff like that not to be extremist or white supremacist, I mean, on the surface doesn't sound like the worst thing in the world or too concerning. But then you're putting it in context of what the comments the Biden administration has made about this plan, because Joe Biden himself had a pretty lengthy preface to this 35-page document outlining his plan. And then Attorney General Garland gave a pretty long speech talking about this plan, and he's really putting it in the context of the January 6th Capitol riots, saying that those Capitol riots were a manifestation of white supremacy, and that's what the government needs to go after. Yeah, I wrote an article that we posted on thetrumpet.com back on May 20th. Titled "Marxism is Dividing America's Military," and there's a point in there where I mentioned that the Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin had hired Bishop Garrison, who's a critical race theorist, as the Pentagon's new extremism czar, and he's tasked with basically combing through all the internet search histories and social media accounts of military personnel, looking for extremist behavior. But then when you look at the man, this Bishop Garrison that they've put in charge of this, I mean, he has social media posts of his own saying that anyone who voted for Trump, all like 74 million of them, are either sexist, misogynist, or racist. And so now you're looking at, okay, you've got this framework that they've put out here that like, oh, we're not going to be focusing on Islamic terrorism so much. We're going to be focusing on white supremacism and the military and in veterans and online. But the officials they're appointing to actually carry out this vision are coming out and just openly saying that they regard basically all Trump support, anyone who's conservative, as a white supremacist, which really raises some concerns about how are you defining the term and what's your ultimate goal for this plan.
Yes, seems like the possibility for a disturbingly broad definition there, very, very concerning. And then this also comes as newly released documents show that the FBI may have infiltrated some of those militia groups involved at the Capitol Hill situation there back in January. Can you talk a little bit about how these two stories connect?
Yeah, that does raise some at least disturbing possibilities, because the government's focusing in on this January 6th protest, trying to claim that there's this huge white supremacist existential threat to democracy, even though it's probably safe to say that most of the people at that protest were not white supremacists. They were legitimately concerned about election fraud. And even amongst some of the groups that have some more legit concerns over being white supremacists, group like the Proud Boys and the 3%ers, there have been new government documents saying that the FBI had actually infiltrated the three of the main militia groups involved with those protests. And so these are probably the extremist fringe of the people at those protests, and some of those people are FBI agents. Now, the documents are only claiming that these people, they'd infiltrated these groups as informants to let the government know what they were up to. Mm-hmm. But there's this new report on Revolver.news. It's entitled "Unindicted Co-Conspirators in January 6th Case Raises Disturbing Questions of Federal Foreknowledge." Even raising the case that they're like, okay, well, there's been several people arrested and not prosecuted, or not arrested from these protests, saying that there's like, at least raises the question, they're like, well, how many of these FBI informants in these militia groups at the protest weren't just informing but actually organizing and inciting these protests to violence? It basically raising the question is that it was the whole thing, at least partially, a government false flag event to crack down on Trump supporters. And I mean, that's still an open story. They're looking into it. I mean, it sounds crazy, but then when you look at what the government did with the Steele dossier and the insurance policy, and then all the patsy setups to frame Donald Trump for Russia collusion, it definitely would have been out of character for them to use some of these same organizations, the FBI, Department of Justice, Department of Homeland Security, to infiltrate some of these militia groups, stir up trouble, and then use that trouble to claim a white supremacist threat to start purging Trump supporters from the military and other government institutions.
Could you place this in the context of Bible prophecy for us and let listeners know what they could read to better understand that?
Yeah, probably the main article put in the show notes today for this story is by our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, from a couple Trumpet print editions back, entitled "America Has No Helper." And that article, it goes through a verse that we've covered on this program and in the Trumpet many, many, many times over the last couple months and years, in 2 Kings 14, 26, verses 27, that talks about this effort to blot out the name of Israel, and how Israel had no helper until God raised up an end-time type of King Jeroboam II to save Israel temporarily. And in that article, "America Has No Helper," Mr. Fleury really goes through a lot of, even in the details of the Mueller investigation of the Russia collusion scandal, showing how basically Donald Trump was the only man in Washington for a long time who didn't know that he was being set up. Like, you had all these deep state agents trying to set him up. You had all these even Republicans who were keeping their mouth shut about it. And just showed that there's really just one man standing to try to save Israel temporarily. And some of these new revelations about just if the FBI was involved in the January 6th riots or January 6th protest in order to, like, create an excuse to cause this crackdown on using basically white supremacy as your excuse to cause this crackdown on Trump supporters and conservatives and online censorship across the nation. I mean, that just really does show the depth of really how America really does have no helper at the moment, and just waiting for God's intervention.
The name of that article, once again, is America Has No Helper, and we will include a link to that in our show notes for today's program. Thanks very much for that, Andrew. Coming up, we'll talk about the Arab element in Israel's new government, the EU's designs on Northern Ireland, China turning the screws on Taiwan, and the growing likelihood of another American Dust Bowl. We'll be back in a moment.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Israel has a new government. After 12 years of Benjamin Netanyahu at the helm, he's been replaced by a coalition led by Prime Minister Naftali Bennett. And Brent put together an excellent segment about this on the June 16th episode of Trumpet Hour. But one topic that he didn't focus on in that segment was the fact that the new government includes Arab parties. So we'll give him an opportunity to do that now. What can you tell us about this, Brent?
Yeah, that's right. This is the first time in Israel's history that an Arab party has formed, has been a part of the government. Of course, there's 1.2 million Arabs inside Israel called Arab Israelis, and they are eligible to vote in the Knesset elections. So much for the apartheid state that you hear people discussing. You do have a large percentage, over 20% of Israel's population, that are Arab, and they vote, of course, in this democracy. But up until this government, we haven't had an Arab-Israeli party or an Arab party as part of the government. But now we have, and that's thanks to the Ra'am party. This is led by Mansour Abbas, different to Mahmoud Abbas, Mansour Abbas, and he won four seats. So he actually has the smallest or equal smallest party in the whole Knesset, and yet he is what is coming out to be a kingmaker for this new government. Of course, Israel's political system is different to what our listeners might be familiar with, or some of them at least based in the United States, where you have parties with anyone can really put forth a party for the Knesset as long as you get over the threshold of 3.5% of the electoral of the voting, you can have a party in the Knesset. And so there's lots of parties in the Knesset, lots of Arab parties or few Arab parties, and now one of those with four seats has joined in with Lapid's Yair Lapid and Naftali Bennett's government. So this is a government that has got some right-wing elements that are in terms of the prime minister, and then mostly centrist left-wing elements, and then for the first time an Arab party, not just any Arab party, but an Arab party that has a Muslim Brotherhood doctrine, Muslim Brotherhood foundation in it. And this is very important, even though it just has four seats, since the majority, since this Knesset has a majority of 61 seats, this government has a majority of 61 seats. If Lapid or if Naftali Bennett decides to do something that is going to be against the interests of this Arab party, they can threaten to bolt the coalition, to bring down, therefore, the government. They could take their four seats with them and dissolve the Knesset because you no longer would have a majority for the coalition. And so even though they've just got four seats, this is a powerful hand that this Arab party holds over this government.
So you mentioned a Muslim Brotherhood kind of a foundation in this party. What can you tell us about this party's view of the very existence of Israel in the Middle East as a nation?
Right. Carolyn Glick draws attention to this in her column this week, How to Understand Naftali Bennett's New Government. And she focuses on this and the fact that they are a Muslim Brotherhood aligned party, and that they have, even before the Knesset, before the vote on Sunday, Ra'am leader Mansour Abbas gave a speech where he said, "We will restore lands that were stolen from our people." This is in the Knesset. And what lands is he talking about? Well, in 2018, he gave a speech that said this, quote, "Since Israel's founding in 1948, the Palestinian people have lived in a continuous disaster that was created by Zionist terror gangs." So when he talks about his lands or the lands of the Palestinian people, the Muslim Brotherhood doctrine and even Islamic doctrine is that once a land has been taken over by Muslims at some point in history, that land needs to be reclaimed if there's foreigners that come in or Christians, whoever else, come and take that land that was once Muslims, it needs to be reclaimed by the Muslim power. And so this is fundamentally what he believes. Now, of course, he's going to, the Muslim Brotherhood is very adept at not being, let's say, as outright as the Iranians in their quest for power. They kind of they will work within the systems of the day to eventually receive or make their objectives. And so, yes, he's part of the government right now. He's not calling on Hamas to fire rockets into Israel, anything like that. However, in the long run, we do have an Arab party now that does, inside the government, that does not believe in Israel's fundamental right to exist as a Jewish state in the land that it occupies.
Yeah, that's just stunning to have a party like that that's part of the ruling coalition of the nation of Israel. Just a really bewildering move there. What can you tell us about how this fits into Bible prophecy?
Well, we know based on a prophecy in Hosea chapter 5 that the peace process with the Arabs and really the way that Israel has allowed inside the democracy and through the Supreme Court has allowed such anti-Israel, anti-fundamental Jewish state parties inside the Knesset. This is surprising, and the Bible talks about how Israel, the state of Israel, or Judah, as it calls it in these times, is going to be like a moth-ridden garment. There, it's going to be eaten away from the inside out, especially in regards to peace process with the Arabs or Arabs getting involved with the government. And we can see that taken to a whole new level now as an Arab party that doesn't believe in Israel's right to exist as a Jewish state becoming the kingmaker or the swinging vote inside the Israeli Knesset right now. Israel has never been beholden to an Arab party like it is right now. And it speaks to this prophecy coming to pass, how the Arabs are going to gain further more control, and it is going to create this situation where Israel is going to lose its strength and its cohesiveness as a nation. Mr. Gerald Flurry speaks about this prophecy in his book, Jerusalem and Prophecy.
We'll be sure to include a link to Jerusalem and Prophecy in the show notes. Well, thanks very much for that, Brent. For the next story, we'll head back over to Europe, where European Union leaders apparently have designs on Northern Ireland. For this, we'll go back to Richard.
Yes, the former Irish Prime Minister earlier this week called for the unification of Northern Ireland with the Republic. And this caused quite an outcry because of exactly that background that you mentioned in the setup. It comes as all these different European leaders make clear they don't regard Northern Ireland as part of the UK, and the EU makes several notable moves on Northern Ireland. Emmanuel Macron, he triggered kind of an outrage where, you know, somebody asked him, well, you know, how would you like it if you couldn't take goods from France to Toulon, or Toulouse, sorry, because that's what the European Union is trying to do with Britain and Northern Ireland. And he said, well, that's not a good comparison because Paris and Toulouse are not part of the same country, you know, implying that London and Belfast aren't part of the same country, which is preposterous and rightly left a lot of people outraged. Now, this is all happening amidst the background of the so-called sausage war, where there's this withdrawal agreement that the European Union is now interpreting in about the strictest possible way, trying to put a border, trying to argue that there must be a border between England and Northern Ireland, that sausages or more substantially medicines and things like that cannot pass from England to Northern Ireland, that they must be that the Northern Ireland basically must be treated as if it's part of the EU when it comes to these different trade deals. And this is all happening amidst the background of political chaos in Northern Ireland. They just had their second leader of the Democratic Unionist Party resign. As one person said, the DUP hasn't had a leadership election for 50 years, and then it had two within 50 days. And there's a lot of turmoil there. What I think is really fascinating about this whole story is that a trumpet columnist forecast this decades ago, you know, writing about this 20 years ago, Mr. Ron Fraser was writing about the Northern Ireland Agreement, the Belfast Agreement, the Good Friday Agreement that ended the so-called Troubles, that was basically a deal with terrorists. And he said, you know, dealing with terrorists never works out. He said, at best, it is a most shameful capitulation to the forces of terrorism. At worst, it contains the sinister seeds of destruction of the very peace that it is touted to produce. He also said that it's entirely feasible that Tony Blair's government, back then he was the prime minister, may find the outcome of the Irish peace process being dictated by the European Union. He saw that this was an avenue for the European Union to get involved there. He warned that, well, he said, the plain fact is that given a few years, the Protestant majority in Ulster will be overwhelmed by the much more rapidly reproducing Catholic minority. It's simply a matter of time that the terrorists just kind of switched to waiting it out. And then we talked about the rising power in Europe, and he wrote, well, will the coming beast power literally leap across to Britain from a united, nationalized, Catholicized island, avoiding the traditional pitfalls of the English Channel, where so many attempts on the island of the British have met their demise? So he saw where this was leading 20 years ago. We see it now. The European Union is using this as an excuse to attack Britain. And you can read more about what Mr. Fraser wrote. He had an article, The Goodbye Friday Agreement, all the way back in the March-April 2000 Trumpet print magazine. And there are other prophecies that this ties into. I mean, the United States and Britain and prophecy talks about how there are all these curses that were forecast to come upon our nations. And we see negotiating with terrorists and this weakness now being used by the European Union to punish Britain.
Yeah, the European Union, you know, it likes to present itself to the world as this tolerant, peace-loving bloc based on equality and freedom, but stories like this really give us a look at what its real motivations are. So we really appreciate that, Richard. For our next story, we'll take a look at China's increasing pressure on Taiwan. For this, we'll turn it back over to Mihailo.
Well, China having a claim to Taiwan is no news. They've been trying to do it for decades now, ever since Taiwan basically became its own country in the aftermath of World War II. But what is news is that on June 15th, China made its largest incursion into Taiwan's air defense identification zone ever. 28 military aircraft, including fighter jets and nuclear-capable bombers. This is really concerning because Taiwan is, of course, a much smaller country than China. They have a real much smaller military. China has about 2,000 fighter jets in its air force, while Taiwan has fewer than 300. Taiwan has basically looked to the United States as a compensation for its defense. And lately, while there was a bit of a resurgence of Taiwanese-American relations under President Trump, since Bill Clinton stated he didn't support Taiwanese independence from China decades ago, American support to Taiwan has been more or less lackluster. And the Chinese, the reason that they have a claim was Taiwan was a Japanese colony after World War II. Japan gave it to China, which was under control of the nationalist government. The communists quickly seized power, and the nationalist government fled to Taiwan. But really, Taiwan has never been a part of the People's Republic of China. It's only technically been a part of a unified China for 5 years. Before that, it was a Japanese colony. So China doesn't really have a claim to Taiwan in the first place. But we've been looking at Taiwan being swallowed up by China basically for a long time. When President Clinton made that statement, our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, wrote at the time that Taiwanese people feel betrayed, and he specifically wrote this in our August 1998 Trumpet issue. How could anyone fail to see that Taiwan is destined to become a part of mainland China? And Taiwan is technically still an independent country, but we've seen an incredibly assertive China. We've seen China being assertive with Hong Kong, stripping away its freedoms, trying to integrate it into mainland China. We've seen it unilaterally seized a bit of territory from Bhutan, which is a South Asian neighbor of it. It's been unilaterally annexing islands controlled by the Philippines, and Taiwan is still on its radar. This is its largest ever military incursion into Taiwanese territory, And China has been waging a pretty successful campaign for the few countries that do still diplomatically recognize China to get them to switch sides, to get rid of the Taiwanese embassies and recognize the People's Republic of China. It did that with Panama in 2017. It recently did it with the Solomon Islands as well. So this is just really a symbol of just the ascent of China and the weakness of America not being able to guarantee Taiwan's protection or a lot of the other allies like the Philippines, their territorial integrity that America was supposed to defend. And really, when it comes down to it, a lot of China is the rising star in Asia, and we can expect it to be rising more and more as the U.S. retreats from there.
Well, thanks very much for filling us in on that, Mihailo. And we also have an article up on thetrumpet.com right now. It's called China Breaks Taiwan Incursion Record. And that will point you to the prophetic context that this fits into. So please head over to thetrumpet.com to check that out. For our final story of the show today, we're going to look at the way drought is arriving dangerously early this year across the American Midwest and what the implications of this are. For this, we'll go back to Andrew.
Yeah, all the states west of the Rocky Mountains are in a dangerous level of drought right now, and it's cut, as you mentioned, it's come very, very early. About 83% of the land area in the western states is in drought, and about 25% of that land area is in extreme drought. And the hottest months of summer are yet to come, so it's pretty safe to say that it's going to get much worse before it gets better. In California, farmers are already destroying their water-intensive crops, knowing that they probably won't be able to irrigate them. Oregon, you're having farmers protesting conservation efforts as the state has to kind of decide whether they're going to give the farmers the water they need to water their crops or send that water to the fisheries to keep a mass die-off of fish in the region. And in Nevada, the water levels behind Lake Mead, that's the famous lake on the Colorado River behind the Hoover Dam, they've dropped the height of a 13-story building, about 130 feet since the year 2000, putting them at their lowest level on record and putting about 40 million people in seven states at risk of water shortages. The United States Department of Agriculture has declared 400 counties as natural disaster areas, and several media outlets are even warning about the possibility of a new dust bowl. On the other side of the Rocky Mountains, they had some flooding a couple years ago that washed away a lot of the topsoil, and then bad farming practices have degraded much of what's left of the topsoil, putting your soil in a really bad place. So if that drought starts spreading east as it is, you could see like something that hasn't happened here in the 1930s where like what's left of that topsoil really starts drying up and blowing away, which would just be a devastating curse on America and something that really needs to wake a lot of people up as to why is this happening. We'll put two resources in the show notes. One, we have an article entitled "Is a Mega Drought on the Way?" It's from about 10 years ago by the trumpet writer Robert Morley that covers a lot of the history about how this drought is the worst in 500 years, and it's even gotten worse in the 10 years since he wrote this. And then also our booklet, "Why Natural Disasters," which really gives the Bible perspective as to why God allows human suffering, but more specifically, why he allows devastating droughts like this to punish societies that have turned away from his law.
Well, thanks very much for filling us in on that, Andrew. We are now coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Please email any questions or comments you may have about today's episode to letters@thetrumpet.com. And thanks to our panel, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, Mihailo Zekic, and Brent Noctegal. And we'll leave you today with these words from Igor Stravinsky. Just as appetite comes by eating, so work brings inspiration. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.